talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the life, loves and legacy of King James VI of Scotland, who became King James I of England, and we'll be debating the impact of one of Britain's most enigmatic and consequential monarchs, who died 400 years ago this year. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Born in 1566, James became King of Scotland at the age of 13 months after his mother, Mary Queen of Scots, was deposed from the throne. His early life was filled with plots, conspiracies and threats to his life, and the threats continued when he succeeded Queen Elizabeth I and became King of England as well as King of Scotland in 1603. James was a king of many contradictions, a peacemaker who tried to avoid wars but who also pioneered the plantation of Ulster, an intellectual who is called the Bright Star of the North, but who was also dismissed as the wisest fool in Christendom. He believed in witchcraft, survived the gunpowder plot, and helped shape Britain's future in ways that still resonate today. And so in tonight's show, we'll explore the man and the myth, his sexuality, and the debates about his legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Anna Groundwater is a principal curator at National Museum Scotland and is an expert on the material culture of Renaissance and early modern Scotland. And she's the co-author of the forthcoming book, Art and Court of James VI and I, Bright Star of the North. Professor Claire Jackson is Honorary Professor of Early Modern History at the University of Cambridge and is an expert on 17th century Britain. She won the prestigious Wolfson Prize for Devil Land, and her new book, The Mirror of Great Britain, A Life of James VI and I, will be published in August. Lucy Hughes Hallett is an award-winning cultural historian and novelist, and she's the author of The Scapegoat, The Brilliant Brief Life of the Duke of Buckingham, published last year. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Gareth Russell, the historian and broadcaster and the author of the new book, Queen James, A New History About the Life and Loves of Britain's First King, James Stuart. Well, you're all very welcome. And Claire, I might begin with you, and I might begin with something that was once said about James, which is that he was the wisest fool in Christendom. And it kind of brings out some of those paradoxes in his life that for some he was a man of great learning, for others he was naive, for some he was not particularly involved in governing and ruling, but to others he was a really transformative king who did so much. And there does seem to be not only a great mythology around James, but also a number of kind of contradictions and paradoxes.
I think more so than many monarchs. I think he does lend himself to that quick soundbite. The wisest fool is often one that's reached for. And certainly when I attempted my biography of James, which really tries to look at the whole life, both as King James VI of Scotland and as King James I of England, I was surprised how often people would sort of very quickly come back at me with either the wisest fool soundbite or that line from the satirical Sellers and Yeatman, 1066 and all that, King James slobbered at the mouth and had favourites. He was thus a bad king. People seem very quick to reach for sort of tabloid headlines. Whether that really, as you say, sort of implies a broader complexity underneath is maybe the case.
And I'm fascinated by the title of your book, The Mirror of Great Britain. And I had to look that up, and it actually was this incredible jewel that became part of the crown jewels. I think disappeared in 1625, the year of James's death. But you're also thinking of the idea of a mirror holding up and how we view and illuminate and understand a particular person or an image.
Exactly. There is a full-length portrait of James that's painted shortly after he becomes King of England, and he's wearing this very prominent hat jewel, which is called the Mirror of Great Britain. It's three large diamonds, a ruby. It's kind of opulent, symbolic endorsement of this vision that he has of a united Britain, because it's constituted from jewels already in the English and Scottish collections. So that's kind of one point. But really, I then sort of tease that out to say actually mirrors supply chains as one of his favourite literary metaphors. In every address to the English Parliament, he says, I am giving you a mirror and you can do what you wish with that mirror, but it's a reflection of my mind. And this is a rare gift and you can break it, you can breathe on it, you can misinterpret my words, but it is a very precious, rare gift. And it's ironic, as I sort of tease out, because James is also a very skilled dissembler, that he loves these metaphors of transparency. And actually, you know, mirrors themselves do reflect present realities, but they all have the capacity technically to distort and deceive. And that's really the sort of point. John Donne, the preacher and poet, later after James's death, reminds Charles II, his son, that likening a king to a mirror was a metaphor in which Your Majesty's blessed father seemed to delight.
You mentioned that he was a great dissembler, but I can completely understand why he had to be, because there was so much violence and danger and conspiracy, and especially in those early years, you know, his mother forced from the throne, James taking over from the cradle, you know, I think only if, you know, 1 year old. And there are all these plots and conspiracies and threats to his life, both in his early years and when he becomes King of England at 37. So it's a very dangerous and difficult origin story for James.
It's a phenomenal story of survival and resilience. And very unsurprisingly, one of the skills you require for that is a capacity to dissemble when needed. So, as you say, this is someone who acceded to the throne at the age of 13 months. So the one thing that he can never remember in his life is not being king. And throughout his young life, there are obviously a series of regents that rule in his name, but his physical safety is taken at a premium. There are always going to be factions loyal to his deposed mother, Mary, Queen of Scots. He also needs to balance pro-English sort of Protestant elements at his court with those who want to revive the traditional Scottish alliance with France. There's also a very shifting noble series of noble factions at the Scottish court. He's also a king who's very used by the time he comes to the English throne with juggling different international factions. Part of his success in maintaining and upholding his right to succeed Elizabeth is both keeping Catholic powers on side by not persecuting Catholics in an unduly violent way in Scotland, by honouring his mother's memory. She is by this stage sort of regarded almost as a sort of unofficial Catholic martyr, while at the same time giving hope to what we call the sort of hotter sorts of Protestants, sort of Puritans and Presbyterians, that he's a Calvinist, he's a true son of the Kirk. And a lot of people often say after they've met James that they are totally convinced by what he said at the time and then slightly dismayed to discover he's apparently said very different things to people that they would regard as their adversaries.
And he wrote a lot. You describe him as a major intellectual. He's interested in witchcraft. He's interested in theological issues. He's the person who, you know, brings into existence what becomes known as the King James Bible. He is very much engaged in the issues of the time and some of the great kind of, you know, theoretical speculations of the time.
Absolutely. He's also unusual. I mean, one could be interested in all of those sorts of things and one could pen memoranda, but he's also fascinated by the new medium of print. He publishes a huge amount, even just as King of Scotland, starting from his teens. His first publications are actually in the field of poetry and verse, as well as poetic manuals about how one should write poetry. While he's King of Scotland, he publishes, as you said, works of political theory. He publishes a manual, a book about demonology. And in England, he continues his first publication in England in 1604, is a counterblast against tobacco, this newfangled vogue for smoking. James is unusual again among monarchs across all the centuries for his willingness to present his ideas in print, to think hard about the physical format of those publications and their genre. He is slightly surprised when subjects respond in kind. I mean, John Donne, again, the preacher and the poet, later says, you know, Your Majesty was unusual. You sort of almost descended to a conversation with your subjects. And James finds later in his life that his printed works are often quoted back at him to show how he's been inconsistent or, as they see, betrayed some of his precepts.
Anna, the time in Scotland, as King of Scotland, it is this incredibly dramatic period. And at the age of 16, he's invited to a castle under the pretext of a hunting trip. And there he's effectively abducted and held prisoner by these noblemen who were attempting to control his reign.
Yeah, so James, that's his experience of life. I mean, it's very much what Claire was saying, is this incredible childhood where the Revan raid, the one that you're talking about, is just one of the many incidents that happen right up until that point. He was actually, I've just found a record of, he was playing tennis just outside Perth before this all happened with a surgeon called Boswell. And then shortly after that, he's spirited away by these nobles who are very keen to fly the Protestant flag. They're worried about the influence, the undue, as they see, influence of his previously Catholic French cousin, Lennox. And, you know, yes, his movements are curtailed for some months until finally there's a sort of counter-rebellion and he's freed. But that's just the latest in a number of incidents, for instance, of his regents that Claire referred to. Three of them died, two of them in, you know, violent circumstances, including one was his father and his grandfather. So this is his experience of life right from the get-go is of precarity, of things not being absolutely a given.
And he does have serious challenges as King of Scotland, and he has to pacify the borders. And then he has even greater challenges after you have the Union of the Crowns.
Mm-hmm. So I think what James has to do, particularly as he comes really into his majority from, let's say, around 1585, is to really stamp Stuart monarchy's authority in Scotland in a way that has been handled by regents, successive regents, the turbulence of Mary Queen of Scots' reign, the impact of the Protestant Reformation going further back. So there have been these challenges to royal authority right up until, as you say, the Revan raid in 1582. In 1585, James really gets his hands on the reins of power, and he sets out to do a number of things, one of which is to really begin to harness the power, the really military power of the Scottish nobles into the hands of the crown. And where they have conducted a sort of informal justice, persecuting their problems through the ancient art of the blood feud, for instance, he's encouraging them to come and settle their problems in court in Edinburgh. And he is saying, you can't do this any longer. And he has this extraordinary event where he gets nobles, feuding nobles, to walk up the Royal Nile, holding hands in a sort of procession of love and amity. His next big thing, as you say, is the pacification in the borders. And part of the reason that's so important is he's at that point in the 1590s trying to show Elizabeth and her councillors that he is the right man for the job in terms of running England after Elizabeth dies, and being able to exert his power to stop the reaving, the raiding in the borders is one way in which he can show that he does actually have the capacity to do that in a persistent manner, in a way that hasn't happened up until that date. And in fact, he is remarkably successful. And I think the thing in the borders is that James lets bad things happen when he wants to get something out of England, and he does this quite successfully. And then Elizabeth pays him a £3,000 annual annuity. So he sets the precedent, really, the groundwork, I think, for Elizabeth being okay with then leaving him the thrones, the Tudor thrones, but also convincing the councillors, particularly of Cecil, but very importantly, of his suitability for the job. And once he gets to London in 1603, the pacification of the borders really ratchets up another notch to encompass both sides of the borders. it's not an immediate job, but I would say by the 1610s, the Borders are very much coming into in behind him.
And it is remarkable, Anna, just the fact that, you know, I think listeners in Ireland may not fully appreciate the complexities of what that actually meant in 1603, because it wasn't that it just became one kingdom now. You still had effectively two kingdoms, separate parliaments, separate institutions, that it really was kind of more, you know, it was a much more complicated position he was in than it might appear.
Yeah, so James wrote about union and the disappearance, if you like, of the significance of that international border between England and Scotland. He said, oh, the Middle Shires, the Borders, he rechristened them, the Middle Shires, they'll just be the middlest of the kingdom and the same as anywhere else in both England and Scotland. And I think really that was James wishing, you know, that was an ideal, and it certainly wasn't the reality. The border, even once people were prepared to shake hands and love each other, which is what he wanted them to do over the border, continues in an institutional way, because Scotland has its own separate parliament, it has its own governing privy council, it has its own separate judicial legal system, and it has its own version of a Protestant church, the Presbyterian version of a Protestant church. And this is all very separate to what's going on in England. So it's not just a, you know, the fact that you've got a king, the union really is only within his own body, within his own kingship of England, Scotland and Ireland and the Principality of Wales. It's a regnal or a regal union and not a political union. And what James does when he gets down to London is, you know, he has to declare himself King of Great Britain, because Parliament actually in England refuses to do that initially until the relationship is sorted out. All the proposals that then come for greater political union involve some diminution of Scottish status within union. And in the English Parliament just wants to subsume basically Scottish laws. And that's something that the Scottish Parliament is never going to agree to. So James immediately faces these problems, these obstacles to having this joyful, a union of hearts and minds, a perfect union. But he faces institutional obstacles and also just a long history of suspicion and some, I would say, xenophobia, particularly sort of anti-Scots feeling in London.
Lucy, there's a wonderful review of your book on the Duke of Buckingham, which describes it as a tale of rogues, riotous sex, regicide and realpolitik. And, you know, it is an extraordinary life, the Duke of Buckingham's, and his relationship with James is central to that. And there has been such interest in the sexuality of James, but it's also something that people were kind of interested in during his lifetime. There were questions that were even being asked while he was alive, even though he did marry Queen Anne, there were still questions about his relationships with men.
Certainly. And of course, the sexuality of a king is extremely important, because one of the king's most important jobs is to produce heirs. And James was married to Queen Anne, and he got her pregnant 7 times. Only 3 of those children survived beyond infancy. But it was known from very early in his life that James loved men. And I mean, this goes back to his early teens. Probably the first person he loved really was his cousin, Esme, the Sieur d'Ombody, who became the Earl of Lennox. But there are certainly contemporary descriptions of the way James would, you know, hang around his neck. And afterwards, he was to have a sequence of young male favourites. And after he came to England, he was very clearly in love for 7 years or so with Robert Carr, a handsome young Scot who'd come south with him, who became the Earl of Somerset and Lord Chamberlain, and extremely rich thanks to James's favouritism of him. Along comes Buckingham, George Villiers, as he then was, who had been really trailed before King James as a piece of sexual bait. But actually what no one had predicted was that George Villiers wasn't just a pretty face and a pretty pair of legs. His legs were very celebrated because he danced beautifully at the court masks. But he was also a great deal cleverer than any of his initial sponsors had imagined. And he soon became a very able and loyal deputy and right-hand man to King James. And James actually wrote to him saying, I am shaping you, I'm making you a tool for my purpose. And James kind of trained Buckingham, as he soon became, to be his kind of his man on the spot. And James, after that terrifying childhood, was very reluctant to show himself in public. I mean, even in court in Whitehall Palace, he was constantly being pestered by suitors who wanted, a place on the Privy Council or a sinecure for their nephew or a rich husband for their daughter. And he used Buckingham as kind of his gatekeeper who would decide who, if anyone, would actually get access to the king, which gave Buckingham great power. And he was very efficient in that role. James prided himself on having brought peace, and he called himself the Rex Pacificus, the King of Peace. And no way was he going to give in to the pressure that was very heavy pressure put on him to engage in war on the European mainland. And Buckingham remained loyal to him and followed his policy.
Well, tonight we are talking about the life, loves and legacy of King James VI of Scotland, King James I of England, on this, the 400th anniversary of his death. And we're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'll be talking to Gareth Russell, the historian and broadcaster, about his new book, Queen James. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and you're very welcome back to our discussion of the life, loves and legacy of King James VI of Scotland, King James I of England. And I'm delighted to be joined by Gareth Russell, the historian and broadcaster, and the author of a brilliant new book, Queen James, A New History About the Life and Loves of Britain's First King, James Stuart. It's a book that explores how James Stuart, King of England, Scotland and Ireland, did not always love wisely, but he never failed to do so boldly. And the book is published in hardback by William Collins. And Gareth, delighted you could join me in studio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can I begin with the title, Queen James? Because yes, it's dramatic, it's provocative, it immediately grabs the attention. And it also goes back to a quote from an English author in 1603, which said, "Then James was queen."
Yes, the English had great fun with James in their jokes. They had less fun with him in their government. But looking back on the armada-crushing Queen Elizabeth, some English people felt quite nostalgic. So they said Elizabeth was king and then James was queen. And for me, it was a gift of a title because, as with today, queen had many different connotations in the 17th century. So it could obviously imply effeminacy, which they were using for his foreign policy. It did have some connotations towards homosexuality in the way that it would today, more as a term of affection. And it also could be a royal title and a slur at the same time. So Queen James, really, from 1603 to 2025, worked quite nicely. And also, but like Ron Seal, it did exactly what it needed to on the tin. This would be a look at him in a different way.
And it's often hard when you look at historical figures to work out their sexuality because things are, rarely documented, and you're relying on different types of sources and accounts. But it seems to be fairly clear cut about James.
I don't think he was ever really in the closet, to be honest. Yeah, the sources are wonderful, and some of them are very affectionate and sweet. And really, the book does look a bit like the six wives of Henry VIII through these six core men that he loved over the course of his life. And from different relationships, there's a different amount of sources. I was actually surprised once I started the research in earnest that there was much more from the earlier romances in his late teens and early 20s than I had initially thought. But some of the letters, as I say, are affectionate. Some are very painful. There's one from a breakup, I suppose we would call it, where James said he couldn't get him express himself properly in speaking. So like many lovers before and since, put it down onto paper, and by a quirk of history it survived. And it's actually sad, very sad to read. And then there are other ones that are erotic and not behind any kind of door. So in terms of creating a biography of a man who once described himself as two men and one body, the particular man, meaning the private man, and the general Christian king, his words. It was absolutely wonderful. There was a treasure trove of sources. And I can understand, you know, the hesitancy that some people have about projecting modern attitudes or modern expectations back onto the past. So I was careful not to do it here, and I hope I succeeded.
Oh, I definitely think so. And how did people around in the court view it at the time? Were they prepared to accept it because he was the king and they didn't want to get into trouble? Were they secretly, privately shocked and disgusted? Or did they have a much more kind of live and let live attitude?
All of the above. There were people who went along with it quite contentedly because he was the king. Many Christians at the time considered adultery to be as much of a sin as homosexual encounters. And so they regarded some of the king's lovers in the way they had king's mistresses in the past. There were some who were disgusted. There were some who were so unfamiliar. They tended to be visitors to court. But there were some diary entries I find where some of these men didn't seem to know what homosexuality was, and they couldn't understand why James was kissing the Duke of Buckingham's neck or saying, "No man ever loved another as much as I love thee." So there was confusion. But there were political pushbacks. So some of his favourites, Lord Philip Herbert, I think he was, you know, he was sort of the person who today would be like captain of the first 13 rugby team, cheerful and sporty. And no one minded Philip because he wasn't political and he wasn't overly greedy. And there were other favourites. Alexander Lindsay was another they didn't mind. When they really objected, it wasn't so much the sexuality. It was when some of the favourites, chiefly the Earl of Somerset and after him the Duke of Buckingham, who began to move into positions of political prominence. And James, as it says in the blurb that you read, loved boldly and he loved totally, which meant that a lot of political patronage, wealth and decisions were handed to the man he loved completely. And that left a lot of other aristocrats and politicians feeling distinctly aggrieved, at which point they discovered their moral objections to the romance.
Now, there was obviously a lot more to his life. And I think we could not only get an entire show on his life, we could probably get a whole series of shows because if this was a TV series, we would be saying that the writers were just, you know, going too far and making up things in the way they were adding on the different layers of drama, because there's kidnapping, witchcraft trials, torture, his mother's beheading, poison, religious fundamentalism, you know, all of these love affairs then, espionage, you know, there's so much in it. So tell me maybe, or tell our listeners about, I suppose, the circumstances of his life, the murder of his father, the struggles that he had, and that it wasn't a very straightforward linear route to the throne.
No, not at all. From an author's perspective, you do sometimes want to feel greedy with the topic that you've chosen. But this was a slightly overwhelming, initially, all-you-can-eat buffet, because it's just a dream for an author how much happened to him. And the political and the personal interweave all the time. So he's born the son of a very famous woman, probably the most famous woman in Scottish history, Mary, Queen of Scots, in 1566. And her universally unliked English husband, Lord Darnley, who is found dead but unlamented in the detonated grounds of a mansion in 1567. Because of his personality, pretty much everyone in the Scottish upper classes is a suspect. Almost no one wants him left alive, but popular suspicion fixes on Queen Mary, who is deposed as a result of it. And baby James is taken from cradle to throne and proclaimed His Majesty King James VI in a Presbyterian coup. And he's sent to Stirling Castle, which I visited, and it's an extraordinary place. It really is in this beautiful crag in Scotland. And he's raised in security and luxury while the other aristocrats play ministerial leapfrog over each other's corpses and reputations to hold the government while he's a child. And as he comes into his teenage years, he realises that the political chaos that destroyed his mother hasn't been buried in his childhood. He is kidnapped by rival lords who want to control the government. He has a cousin who's very dear to him banished, and then his heart is sent back embalmed as proof that he's dead. There is a massive witchcraft trial in Scotland called the North Berwick Witch Trials that really is sort of the British Isles equivalent of the Salem Witch Trials. James initially thinks the whole thing is nonsense and points out, not unfairly, that if you keep torturing people, they might tell you whatever they want to hear. But then he is convinced by one of the alleged witches himself in an interrogation and becomes a full-throated supporter of the witch hunts. Then he inherits the English throne and the Irish throne and also the government of Wales when Elizabeth I dies in 1603. And at that point, he becomes a lot richer. He admits at one point that he used to have nightmares that his seemingly immortal English cousin Elizabeth I would play one last horrible trick by outliving him, so he wouldn't get his hands on that. And, you know, he's responsible for things like the Plantation of Ulster to a large degree. He survives the Gunpowder Plot. He authorises the translation of the King James Bible that many Protestants still think of as sort of the supreme English language translation of Scripture. And he's a keen proponent of the divine right of kings. So between that and writing the first anti-smoking book and a guide for witch hunters and reflections on the Ark of the Covenant, you're dealing with an intellectual stronghouse of a man who doesn't ever seem to have a quiet, peaceful moment. And I don't think it's a surprise that actually all he ever seemed to be looking for was peace.
And this is the era when Shakespeare writes Macbeth, and you have the three witches, because of course that's something that's going to resonate with the king because of his interest in witchcraft.
Yeah, absolutely. Shakespeare's working hard when the Stuarts take over the English throne, because Elizabeth I was sort of indifferent to Shakespeare and he wanted royal patronage. James actually, I think, found Shakespeare a bit of a bore, whereas his wife, Anna of Denmark, who was a remarkable patron of the art, she quite liked Shakespeare, but he cozied up to James with Macbeth. And when that didn't work, he wrote a play called Hamlet about a Danish prince, and he picked Elsinore, which was Queen Anna's childhood home, Helsingør. And so he's trying, you know, there's a reason why Scottish and Danish royalty become a big thing in Shakespeare's quest to get that royal signature and patronage.
And he seems to have had a good relationship with his wife, despite, you know, perhaps not being sexually interested in her. And as you say, she was a great patron of the arts. There's great stuff written about her and her role and her career. And it does seem to have been quite an effective partnership.
I find Anna remarkable in many ways, in every way, actually. And she was a joy to write about as well, partly because she's not the perfect, you know, sort of that horrible old stereotype of the long-suffering wife. I mean, Anna could compete in politics and often did. I mean, she also was wildly extravagant. She never met a diamond she didn't want. But she was, someone described her once as full of kindness to those she loves and terrible to those she does not. And that summarizes her neatly. Deciphering from their private letters when she figured out that he was more interested in men than her was fascinating. And she was upset. I think there is pretty decent evidence from around 1600 that she was seriously shocked, or at least upset by how far it had gone on this particular incident. There were ramifications for the monarchy, which was always Anna's prime motivation and goal. She was an ultra-monarchist and very much family-oriented, and I suppose for her those two things are inextricably linked. But she then decides that if James is going to have male favourites, firstly, she better be involved in picking them, because she has doubts about his taste, fully justified doubts, I would add, and also that, you know, there is a benefit to her. Male lovers are actually more convenient than female mistresses. There aren't going to be any children from a union like that, which might challenge her own. And also, there's a level to which Anna knows that James can push these favourites only so far, but socially, no one's ever going to rival her. So she makes the best of it. And actually, there's some fabulous letters I find between the two of them, one of which was James telling her that a 70-year-old aristocrat was marrying a 20-something aristocrat. And, you know, he says, "I'm only telling you so that you don't burst out laughing when you hear it in public. Just please, please be polite about it and don't tell anyone." And she writes back. I mean, I laughed. One of the few times in an archive I've laughed. But she wrote back and she said, "Your Majesty, I would humbly ask that you inform me how it is possible to keep a secret that I have already told to everyone I have encountered." And then she sort of rinses this septuagenarian earl. But probably my favourite anecdote about her was when she took real umbrage to one of James's favourites. She gave a gift of diamonds to her new, her choice for his next boyfriend, and had him parade around the palace wearing them. And then she started staging plays in which the new favourite was cast in a series of decreasingly full costumes in order to catch James's eye. So Anna was someone who was very, very good at playing the hand dealt to her.
You've mentioned one of the favourites, Buckingham, the Duke of Buckingham, who had been called at one point the handsomest man in the world. What I find really funny there is that he's, of course, a character in the Dumas novel, The Three Musketeers, where he's the lover of the French queen. And it's a very different portrayal there. But he seems to have been quite a significant love.
He was. He's not someone who has a great press. I mean, even in the Dumas novel, where he's a bit of a charming Lothario, George, the Duke of Buckingham, doesn't have a great historical reputation, but he was hugely significant. And there were things I discovered in the research that were more nuanced, and I liked him a little bit more coming out of the book than going into it. His life, you mentioned the handsomeness, his life was shaped by his looks in a way that I think extraordinary beauty often does shape the early life of people who have it. And it's remarkable. I mean, there were dozens of accounts. The first thing that everyone comments on is how good looking he is, and sort of tall, in great shape, blue eyes, dark hair, and quite unusually for the 17th century, perfectly straight white teeth. So he does stand out. He's also very, very charming, and that's less easy to quantify for the biographer. But he is the lover that Anna pushes forward in the Diamonds and the plays to catch James's eye. And he becomes, I think, probably the last great love of his life. They're together for nearly a decade. And James pulls him through the ranks of the aristocracy from really being the second son of a minor family that had holes in their castle roof they couldn't afford to fix, to being the Duke of Buckingham and the wealthiest man in the country outside the royal family. He has a less than positive impact on Ireland because the Catholic elite at the time are raising sort of some questions about the number of Protestants that seem to be flooding into the country. And George says, well, you know, what would be a great idea is if there were just more Protestant aristocrats, and then that would balance the concerns in the elite. And I've come up with a great scheme on how to sell titles to wealthy English social climbers, which he makes a fortune from. And the Catholic aristocrats of Ireland have sort of stomach acid churning in horror what they're seeing coming in. So George is ruthless when it comes to money in particular, and he does make some, being polite, seriously questionable political decisions. But when you read the letters between them, you know, James referring to him as my wife and George calling him my husband, there are some pretty obviously sexual letters between the two of them. And you know, when George goes on a diplomatic mission, James writes and says, I have to ride away from everyone today because the tears were streaming down my face. All I want is you in my arms. So I do think, at least from James's perspective, it was a very deep love.
And there was almost a 30-year age gap, which seems a bit hypocritical then to be making fun and teasing the 70-year-old aristocrat for marrying, because that's a 50-year age gap. Well, there's a bit of an age gap with him as well.
Yeah, he gets slightly more sensitive about that as he gets older. And in fact, the previous squeeze, the Earl of Somerset, his ex, the diplomat Thomas Overbury, said, you should tell the king that you are not an old man yet and you can't spend all your time with old men, which I think Somerset obviously does not decide to pass on as a message to the king. But what's bizarre, I mean, it's one of those things you can spot but you can't quite analyse, is that the age of the men James is in love with never changes. His does, but it's always early 20s. Although with George, obviously, it lasts quite a bit longer.
He's sometimes, this is James now, he's sometimes criticised for being politically naive, but I wonder, was there a shrewdness there when it came to foreign policy and the way he avoided major wars, the way he did take this kind of intellectual approach to foreign policy and was more kind of a peacemaker than a warlike monarch?
That was one of the most impressive takeaways I had with him, that the amount of criticism that came at him in the last sort of 6 years of his reign about why England was the only Protestant country in Europe that wasn't involved in the 30 Years' War, particularly because one of the initial causes was the overthrow of his daughter and her Protestant husband by the Catholic Habsburgs. Why was England, you know, being so enfeebled and effeminate is the criticism of James. It's very loaded, and Parliament does use language that's trying to link the foreign policy to the private life, which shocked me just how close they came to outright saying that it was because James had male lovers that he didn't know how to fight like a real man. But when you look at the catastrophe that the 30 Years' War inflicted on nearly every country that was involved in it, James's hand-wringing about it when it broke out was bang on the money. You know, we can't afford this. It will lead to untold shedding of blood with a very uncertain outcome. And he did, to his credit, he held firm, you know, canoed against the tide of public opinion, and it decimated his popularity in England. There was a great shrewdness there. Also, as King of Scots, he was very impressive, but I think he obviously understood Scotland better. And he learnt very early on to make sure the right hand didn't know what the left one was doing. And he was a skilled liar when it came to politics, but then, you know, he was a politician.
He survived the gunpowder plot, and of course there's that huge religious dimension to that. I wonder, was there a homophobic element, or were any of the conspirators aware of his sexuality, and did that contribute to the animosity?
With the gunpowder plot, I don't think so. I don't know. Actually, what really seems to inspire Guy Fawkes is not just hatred of Protestants, but also specifically hatred of the Scots. There is this massive tide of anti-Scottish xenophobia that builds up because James refuses to be parted from the Scottish servants and advisors that he'd grown up with in Scotland, and many of whom had served him very loyally. So there's brutal attacks in public debates on the King's Scottish advisors, and where you start to see the first real linking of the two is slightly after the gunpowder plot with a political satire called The Isle of Gulls, which is a very, very successful play staged by the London theatre companies about a completely fictional country called Arcadia, so beautiful and perfect, that is taken over by the king of a rival country. And he's called Basilius, which is a clear nod to James's book, Basilicon Doron, that he'd written about politics. And in the play, Basilius is surrounded by a series of dubious male favourites whom he's far too close to, and he's spending too much money on them and refuses to go to war. And the play's publishers tried to insist, no, this has nothing to do with the king, except the actors then got on stage and played the king and all his favourites with Scottish accents. So it's slightly after that they start to link the opposition to James with the private life. I think it hadn't quite leaked out of the English court by the time the gunpowder plot happened. But I was surprised that, yes, you're right, there was a huge religious element to it. And the core goal of the gunpowder plot was to wipe out the Protestant ruling class in one go by detonating the opening of Parliament. But a major, major motivation for a lot of them, including Guy Fawkes, was deep-rooted anger that there was a Scottish King of England.
In the title, it makes reference to the fact that he's Britain's first king, because he's King of England, he's King of Scotland, now he's also King of Ireland as well. He had grand visions for Britain, but was there problems from people in England and Scotland who really didn't want to be joined and saw themselves as separate nations?
I think it was the great disappointment of his life. In many ways, he's the first unionist, which just adds another layer of the drama you were mentioning at the start and what you could talk about with him. He truly believes that union is inevitable and it's also in everyone's best interest. It's slightly more complicated what his policy was towards Ireland and if he would have seen himself necessarily as a unionist in that context, because his rhetoric in favour of the union is primarily geographical, which makes him, again, even more problematic for today, because whilst he might be the first unionist, a lot of his arguments in favour of unifying Scotland with England sound suspiciously like the arguments in favour of unifying Northern Ireland with the Republic, which is we're all on the same piece of land, therefore it's clearly meant to be that we're the same political entity. And the English, almost to the last man, think that's ridiculous. And half of Scotland thinks it's also nonsense. So he arrives in England and thinks, well, this is a done deal. I am king of both, therefore the government will be unified as both. And the English Parliament make it rapidly and stridently clear that they're not going to support the union. So yes, with the title Britain's First King, we had to make sure not to say Great Britain's First King, because the union he wanted between England and Scotland didn't come into effect until the reign of his great-granddaughter Queen Anne in 1707. And Parliament fights him every step of the way. And James sort of gets all the window dressing of the union done. So the union flag is drafted. There's a brilliant sketch of some of the early ideas they had for it. I think they probably went for the right one. Some of the early decisions for the flag were hideous. But James was really involved in this, and ideas about free trade and single currency, to the extent that actually he is the reason why the flag got the nickname Union Jack, because the Latin for James is Jacobus, and everyone knew he was so keen that they called him Union Jack, and the flag that he helped design, Union Jack. So his role in creating a political union that he wanted is ultimately a great failure. However, the fact that the two countries, Scotland and England, are ultimately ruled by the same dynasty after 1603 does set in motion a process whereby within a century, English people will have gone from being gung-ho against the union to being the people most in favour of it. So he fails in life but succeeds in death.
And it is extraordinary to think about the centuries that followed and attitudes to homosexuality and the fact that people would have returned and quoted the King James Bible in their support of keeping homosexuality illegal, homosexual acts, whereas they were relying on a Bible that had been brought into existence, the King James Version, by someone whose own sexuality would have been offensive to them.
Deeply so, and I think that's part of the reason why a lot of historians, particularly in the 19th and 20th century, tried to find other ways to explain some of the letters or to ignore them. And I try not to be too harsh on those historians. I mention it briefly at the start of the book and I think a sentence. But when I'm doing interviews or talking about them, I always say you have to remember that when they are writing, James has been dismissed almost since the time of his death as a bad king because he was a lecherous man. It's one of the main reasons. And anti-royalist writers in the 1640s have a field day with sort of presenting his political life as a moral horror show, when it clearly shows how unfit he and the entire royal family are to rule. And so when you're trying to rehabilitate James in the 19th and 20th century as a serious and often very effective monarch, you have to say that the homosexuality aspect is a slur and that it's a lie, because there is no way to rehabilitate a homosexual as king, and even for a 1950s historian. So in many ways, this is trying to put James back into a really rich and fascinating context. Obviously, private life is not irrelevant, particularly, I mean, even today, if we were writing a biography of Charles III, you wouldn't say his private life is irrelevant or his political life is completely absent. And with the era of personal monarchy, it's even more clearly defined that it does matter. It did shape his life. It had massive impacts on his political reputation when he was alive. And so there is something for me quite endearing about the way he refused to hide it at court. But there is also a rich irony that many of the people who came after him could only find a way to defend him by denying something that he himself had refused to deny.
Well, it's an excellent new study. It's called Queen James, A New History About the Life and Loves of Britain's First King, James Stuart. It's published in hardback by William Collins. The author is Gareth Russell. And Gareth, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History, and we are talking about the life, loves and legacy of King James VI of Scotland, King James I of England, on this, the 400th anniversary of his death. I'm rejoined by my brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Anna Groundwater, Professor Claire Jackson of the University of Cambridge, and Lucy Hughes-Hallett. Claire, where does the reputation of James stand in this year, the 400th anniversary of his death? Because there are so many significant moments in British history, in Irish history, that are connected to him. The gunpowder plot where they attempted to assassinate him in 1605 in Ireland. You know, he's associated with the plantations, and I've talked to you on the show about their impact. We also have the King James Bible, that there is so much that he is directly associated with, and so much that is his leadership that was driving it through.
It's a very interesting and multifaceted legacy. But I think if one perhaps surprising aspect is just the sheer richness of the scholarship currently being undertaken on James. One of the difficulties, I think, with James's reputation is A, that it became really quite polarised around perhaps his private lives and that sort of aspect. But also, you know, the whole of the British Isles is ripped apart in the middle of the 17th century by the very devices and bloody civil wars. And for a long while, you know, James was swept up in, you know, to what extent could blame for the civil wars be left at James's door? And the reign of his son, Charles I, is clearly ends in sort of disaster and regicide. So I think sort of disentangling James from the civil wars, looking at James actually over a very long period, one of the problems slightly has been as well that English historians tend to focus, understandably, on the sort of 1603 to 1625 period and assume that, you know, he sort of somehow drops from the clouds as a sort of new king. But actually taking stock of a king who ruled over six decades changed quite a lot in those decades and addressed, as you say, very sort of different challenges at different points in his reign, whether that's widespread confessional warfare towards the end of his reign or noble faction in the very early stages of his Scottish reign. I think just appreciating the richness of that leaves one with the impression of a very energetic king.
Anna, there's wonderful insights you can gain about his reign from the material culture that we have preserved. And there's some wonderful stuff that in that forthcoming book about the art and court of James VI and I that you see and that you do have at National Museum Scotland, that it does give very interesting insights by looking at things like the jewellery and the artworks and the clothing from the reign.
Yeah, so I think James was someone who really knew the power of the object, the power of visual culture, and he used it to promote his own idea of Stuart monarchy, but also the idea of Great Britain, Britain the brand, if you like. And we at National Museum Scotland have a number of pieces that relate to King James. In fact, most pertinently with Lucy here, is a watch given by James, made by a Scottish watchmaker, David Ramsay, to Robert Carr, Earl of Somerset, in around 1615, so just before his sort of cataclysmic downfall. And it's the most astonishingly beautiful double-sided pocket watch, which you can open up in two ways, made by a Scottish watchmaker in London, and it's engraved. Firstly, and I think this reflects something of the complexity of James's private life and court life, on one side, it has this wonderful picture of James with Anna, his wife and queen, standing underneath a canopy estate with the British coat of arms. And if you flip it open on the other side, it is engraved with the Earl of Somerset's newly created coat of arms, with a special mark of favour from James.
Well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Anna Groundwater, a principal curator at National Museum Scotland and one of the co-authors of the forthcoming book Art and Court of James VI and First Bright Star of the North, Professor Claire Jackson of the University of Cambridge, whose new book, The Mirror of Great Britain, A Life of James VI and First, will be published this August. Lucy Hughes-Hallett, the award-winning cultural historian and novelist, whose book The Scapegoat, The Brilliant Brief Life of the Duke of Buckingham, was published last year. And we also were joined by Gareth Russell, the historian and broadcaster, whose new book is Queen James, A New History About the Life and Loves of Britain's First King, James Stuart. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We have more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.